Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 257 of the Board Game Barbecue, brought to you by Advent Games and our wonderful Patreons. This is Mike today hosting, and I'm joined here by a couple fellow Aussies. I've got in the left corner, Connor. How you doing, bud?
Am I in the left corner?
It's hard. You're in the left corner on my screen.
Right, okay, yes. I'm here, and I do know my left from right, although, like, recently I've been a little bit turned about. So, yeah, good. Good to see you, Mike. I feel like we've had a couple on.
I've seen you a bit more often lately. Yeah. It's been lovely.
Yeah, yeah. It's like when the teachers, like, start sitting you together in, like, seating plans. It's like,
is that because we're the naughty boys? Is that what's
probably
happening?
We're the fun ones. We're the fun ones.
I prefer that terminology as well. To the right corner, we have a returning guest today, another fellow Aussie who's not currently in Australia, I don't believe. We have Matt Dunstan. Welcome, mate.
Hello. I am actually in Australia. I've moved back to Australia now. I'm in Newcastle right now.
Yes. Welcome back.
Newcastle, Prague. I mean, they're pretty much the same thing, let's face it.
Yeah, definitely. Like both large country towns, you know. That's yes.
Well, it's absolutely wonderful to have you back, mate.
No, thank you for having me. A pleasure to be back.
It's been nearly 2 years, I think. Yeah, or it was 2021, definitely.
I was looking at it today. So I think it was November 2021. That's how long ago it was.
A few small world events have happened since, I guess, you know. So
little ones.
Some things have changed for me. You know, I've moved to Australia in the meantime. So it's and other bits and pieces. But we still all are here for games, and that's the main thing.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. And the good thing is about 2 year gap in between is that there's no reason you wouldn't have done your oath. So we'll get to that later. But, you know, that's good to know. That's good to know. And having the background there. But
I'm only a little bit worried. It's okay.
It's okay. You don't have too much to worry about. There's not high consequences, just a public shaming. So nothing too much to worry about. But look, to get us into it, man, how are you? What's been happening in the world of Matt Dunstan?
I'm well, thank you. I've only been back about 6 months. It's not that short a period of time. But getting used to different way of life, different way of living. What can I say? It's been a bit of a whirlwind few months and year. Happy to kind of connect with especially both of you. So I was saying just before in the prelude, you know, I went to the Powerhouse meeting and saw one of your podcasts recording live, which was a lot of fun, and slowly getting to know some other, you know, designers and game people in Australia. So that's all been really good. And trying to do some work at the same time, trying to design, whether that works or not, we'll see. I'm well. Thank you.
I know one of the things we mentioned in the prelude about the live show is Mike sort of going, oh, Ian O'Toole, like, he's the best, he's my favorite artwork, yada, yada, yada. And one of our patrons was like literally pointing, he's like, he's here, he's right here. And we're like, Mike, he's there. And it was nice. It was like a fanboy moment. Like, it was meeting your idol. And, you know, when they say,
you're saying good things, right?
I was saying good things. Could have gone the other way.
It's rubbish or whatever. No, that was cool. That was so fun. And that does feel like forever ago. So was that kind of not long after you'd moved back to Newey?
Yeah, exactly. So it would have been, what was it like? February, March, somewhere around there, maybe. I don't know. April. So it shows how much I penciled it. I'm actually going to give a talk at the next one, which I think is at the end of September, so in about a month's time.
Awesome.
It was good. It was good. I also had where I didn't recognize Ian when we met at the same event. So I'm sorry, Ian, if you're listening, but I wasn't expecting you to be there because it's a bit of a trek. I mean, I know, but I now understand it was because of the Board Game Barbecue convention or game day or whatever you call it that weekend, which I didn't get an invite to. I was very
maybe Ian's thing is just springing on people.
He's just always like just testing you. Are you on? Are you? It's like, yeah, know what's going on. You know.
Yeah. It's a good way to make sure people are saying nice things about your work is just popping up randomly at different places and be like, hey, what did you say? But enough about Ian, because congratulations on being nominated for the Spiel des Jahres. That's incredible. Like, is it nearly like crazy and dreamlike that it happened?
Yeah, it was not something I was necessarily expecting. You know, as a game designer, you don't say this out loud very often, but, you know, you have some years where you have a game or two and you think, oh, you know, it's in that kind of thing. Maybe it could be nominated, et cetera, et cetera. And often mostly you're disappointed because it doesn't get nominated, of course. And this year I didn't really have that. It was only one friend in Germany who had messaged me a bit before the announcement saying like, oh, I think Next Station is really good. I think it could get nominated. And it really was, for me, it was a real surprise. So yeah, just the nomination and everything was really just a really, really nice experience. And I went to the ceremony in the end. I decided to go to Germany because it's like one of those things that, I mean, you never know if it's going to ever happen again. But at the same time, I sort of knew I probably wasn't going to win. I was pretty much like, you know, it was like 95% chance one of the games was going to win, and we were sharing the other 5% between the other two nominees. It was funny because I was with Kasper Lapp, who is the designer of Fun Facts, Danish designer, and we know each other a bit. It was good to see him again. But it was funny because he had gone through this experience before. He designed Magic Maze, which you might know was created for the Spiel some number of years ago. And, of course, that was the same year that Codenames was nominated. So we were sort of discussing that feeling of like like you're just waiting for like the execution to happen a little bit. Like you're going through – it's like a really nice kind of weekend and you've got like a dinner and ceremony, but you kind of know what's going to happen. You're just sort of like going through the paces and saying all that, it just meant that I could enjoy it more because I was just less stressed. You know, you just sort of like
news.
Like,
yeah, for sure.
When I was nominated for Elysium and like, yeah, for the Kinderspiel, it was just, I really thought we could win. So you're like, you're just a lot more, you know, you can't relax in the same way. But this was just like, you got to really enjoy it and just really enjoy meeting up the other designers. You know, it's just the first year for a while that the Kinderspiel was part of the awards. So there were like 9 different games and actually the special prize for Unlock, so there were like a whole lot of like just like more people than normal, and there's a convention that goes on in Berlin at the same time on the same weekend. It's kind of like maybe the biggest German like non-huge like Spiel convention, which was also super cool to kind of see that kind of more kind of local German scene, if that makes sense. And yeah, just the whole weekend was just really, it was just really nice. It's just really nice to see people just chat with the other designers, because you don't, as a designer, you're often just sitting by yourself in a room in front of a computer. So these moments where you get to actually talk with other people in real life is a really nice point.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good point, because it's not like a lot of other jobs or hobbies where you're probably sitting down, and I'm sure there is some collaboration, but designing something is such a solo experience, which surprises me that Mitch hasn't made a game yet because he loves spending time by himself.
He's not even here to defend himself.
That's when I do it, because he's like the one member who physically scares me. Like everyone else, I don't really care about. But yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that before. Whereas, you know, I work in an environment that's super collaborative, you know, you're spending time with other people all the time. So yeah, I hadn't really thought about that.
It was a very well deserved award, like nomination, because like it's a great game. Like a friend showed me when it got nominated. I hadn't played it yet, and a friend brought it over and showed it to me, and I instantly, all right, let's go buy this game, and boom, sold out everywhere. Like you couldn't get a copy. And that's an amazing thing. You know, like that sort of flow and effect from that sort of nomination, I think is a really good thing for the designers. Your game's going to get noticed a lot more and sell out everywhere and make it a hot, hot, hot game to get. So I'm still trying to get a copy. I've got to try again to get it. I'm sometimes getting in trouble for buying too many games, so don't tell anyone. But no, it was a fantastic game. And one of the things I loved about it, I feel it shares things from other games. It is. It's not a huge box, and it's a nice small box. It fits easy to carry around, and it shares some of those really cool things. I was I'm a very big fan of Guild of Merchant Explorers. It's another fantastic game of yours, and I see some of the similar things, and I love the games like a lot of yours where all the players have the same choices, and watching how everyone branches out and use those same choices to do something different. And it's such a really cool mechanic. I wanted to share. So I was lucky enough to go to Gen Con last year, and that's when I learned about Merchant Explorers, or Guild of Merchant Explorers, sorry, and got to play it. Are you aware of the what happened with your game at Gen Con last year?
Did they play a big game like at the game night or something like that?
700 people, I think it was, we played it with. So there was about 700 people playing Guild of Merchant Explorers, where giant cards of your game were being shown to everyone and walked around like, you know, it looked like, you know, when boxing's happening and they come around with a number above their heads.
The ring people.
Yeah. Giant cards walking around and showing what move they're doing. And I've never done that before. And that was such a cool experience playing this cool new game with all these people. And like, it was really something special, man. It was like a great game to do with as well, because you got 700 people getting the same option to do and going off on all the little branches. It was really cool.
Yeah, no, I mean, AEG really, they like that kind of game night experience. They really have like honed that kind of thing. I'm really, really happy. I mean, firstly, full points for getting the name right, even two times, because that, you know, like, not, you know, it's a difficult name to get. I enjoy games where I'm a big Roll and Write fan. I play a lot with my wife, and we've played, you know, it's probably one of the most kind of played style of games that we do together. And that kind of, you know, like building your own thing, like doing your own thing and trying to make the most best of what you've got, and that bit of randomness. And like, I think that kind of combines, you know, a lot of fun aspects into like a small package. And I guess I try and do that in, you know, in some of my designs. And yeah, exactly. I think Next Station London, it was one of those really fortunate things that in the development, I just, it used to be a lot more complicated. It's very normal with a lot of games. And then I came across, you know, this particular mechanism of, you know, revealing the station, that's where you go to. And then that kind of solved a lot of things, and it made the game a lot simpler. And it means that it's much more, you know, the flow is just a lot better. Still really surprised at how well it's been received. And a lot of, you know, people come up to me and say, you know, I've played it 200 times, I've played 150 times. It's like, often aided by Board Game Arena, which has been a big thing for the game as well. And I'm like, you've played it far more than I have, I can tell you that. But it's a special thing when you have a game that has a life like that. You don't always imagine, not all of your creations get that kind of life. So, you know, I've been really fortunate with that.
I really wanted to ask, Guild of Merchant Explorers, was it ever a roll and write first before it became a game on the board? Because when I first played, I'm like, oh, I could see this as a roll and write, except for the part of removing cubes again and then having to put them out again. I'm like, oh, if you could rub them out. And a few other people I played with said, oh, I could see this being a roll and write as well. So I wanted to ask you, I was actually really excited to ask you, was it ever a roll and write at some point?
It was not, no, it was always the form that it currently is. It was, you know, it was always kind of like an exploration game. And I think we had the idea of that kind of physicality. And I think also that kind of permanence and lack of permanence with, you know, that you have to kind of get rid of all of your explorers every round. I think that was always a pretty core part of the game. And I think we had a physical way of doing it. And I think we were probably quite inspired by something like Kingdom Builder. It does have this kind of form factor that's sort of like in the Kingdom Builder kind of like world, if that makes sense. And so, yeah, I don't think we ever thought of having it as a roll and write. Because I think I like physicality in games. Like, I like having a bit of a table presence. Yeah. And I think it's nice to, I mean, I'm with those people who would ask for like slightly larger cubes. I probably would have chosen slightly larger cubes in the game. I know it's can be a little bit fiddly for folks, but having that kind of table presence and sort of kind of seeing what you've done, I think it's different when it's in 3D versus like on a sheet.
I don't mind the Philly pieces. Oh, no, no, no. My piece was meant to be on that next one. No, that's exactly where it was supposed to go.
Oh, no. Oh, my bad. Had you ever played around with people's having individual actions with the game as opposed to everyone having the same actions? Like, because when Mike sort of said, I could see this as a roll and write, with lots of roll and writes, the whole point is, all right, so I roll a set of dice and I get those actions, and then you roll a set of dice and you get those actions. Obviously, it's not a roll and write, but it does kind of have some similarities, as Mike said. So did you attempt that? Was that something that you just said, nah, too hard? Or the fact that it didn't really fit the theme of, hey, you need to make the best of the situation and make it suit you?
No, I don't think we ever thought of having... I mean, you kind of already have that idea of having your own, because you have these kind of special power cards that you kind of acquire over the course of the game. I don't know when they came into the game, because I doubt they were the thing we started with, but I think we always... Because there's kind of this core set of actions that you need to have access to, like if you never get access to Explore C, for example, then you're a bit screwed.
You never live in that first island. Yeah.
No, exactly. So I think we knew that the actions had to kind of be shared. And actually, because it's a very... I guess that has been interesting, I think, with Next Station and Guild of Murderous Stories. They're both roll or ice or flip fills, but actually with a very small set of possibilities. Like there's, you know, in the starting deck for Guild of Murderous Explorers, it's like 5 cards or 6 cards or something. And with Next Station London, it's like 10 or 11 cards. It's not a lot. So I always like that because it kind of is crossing, you know, like a pure roll and write is randomness, right? Like you're just rolling dice. You have no idea what you're going to get each round. You could roll 6 every turn or whatever. And of course, like something which has no randomness, then there's nothing. But that kind of like that as small as possible randomness as is interesting. I'm kind of interested in that space where you can... You don't quite know what's coming up, but you can you have more strategy about going like, oh, this has already come out. I know that these are the next two cards. I can plan my next two moves. Oh, what if this one comes before that one? How do I think about that? And I think it opens up, like that's an interesting space that I like to sort of look at where people can really start to make, you know, like it's semi-random, I guess, is the point.
But there's still like yeah, you're right. I see what you're saying. But all those outcomes a potential to still come up every time, right? As opposed to a die, like you said, could just be 6 and 6. You know that once that's done, that you've exhausted it, unless you have a special card that allows you to repeat an action or something like that. So, yeah, cool.
You got a sense of deduction as well because, you know, when 4 of those normal cards have come out, you know what's coming out next or it's going to be one of these 2 cards. So
exactly.
You've got that, oh, okay, well, I can start planning for this because, you know, the sand cards haven't come out yet. So I know that's going to happen soon. So I might want to lean over this way to take advantage of that once it comes out. Or God damn it, why didn't that card come out? I was about to cross the river to get to that island and it just gets you angry in a great way.
Exactly, and you need both, right? Because you feel smart sometimes, but it still gives you those moments of exasperation or like, oh wow, this just happened exactly as I wanted. I needed the sea to come out, and then the sand, and then you know, like it's that kind of secret sauce between, you know, like a lot of people talk about like family games. You need some amount of randomness to feel like that even if you're slightly less skilled, you still have an opportunity to win.
I think that's
an important thing in these games. I mean, and the total random roll and writes, which are fine, and like then you're kind of gambling against this like very static probability, you know, like I kind of know what the general probability of whatever is happening, but it doesn't have that thing where you lean into going like, oh, because these are things have come out, now I can change my strategy because I know that these other cards are going to come out. You know, you can't do that when it's completely random.
So the last time, the last time I had a chat to the podcast, you mentioned how you find online playtesting, I'm going to say frustrating. So you find it frustrating to do online playtesting. You've obviously, you know, designed a lot of games since then, you know, had to do some playtesting potentially online. Have you found it more tolerable? Have you found some tricks of the trade that can help you? Or have you just sort of made sure you've had people around you all the time so you can do it in person?
Yeah, I haven't. I did not change my opinion on online playtesting and I don't do any of the current moment and I haven't done any for quite some time. which is a bit of a problem in a way because I'm a little bit of a community in Newcastle, but I still have to kind of find my space and, you know, find a good group. It's just not like it's just too much like work. You know, I think for me that the really fortunate thing about playtesting, you know, with an in-person group is that it's fun. It's like you're going to see your friends. Like it's like a game night, you know, each week that you get to go to. And you have to like prepare a prototype and be ready to, you know, think about things. But it's still, I think, first and foremost, it has to be something you're enjoying going to. And unfortunately, online playtesting for me at least felt a lot too much like work. And that combined with that it tended to be like late in the evening and I'm not much of an evening person. And it's just like after you spent the whole day in front of a computer, you're going to sit down at like 8:30 and like, as I now talk to you both, you know, in front of the computers. But, you know, it's hopefully this is somewhat enjoyable for you. It just takes all the stuff I love about playtesting. You know, it's like for me, it's a weird kind of. I think that's why I know that I was happy being a designer and I knew I was sort of in the right kind of work because it didn't feel like work. You know, with a good group, it's just, you know, you're just happy to meet up and playtest these games and like the playtesting is almost just or like the progress in a game or designing is just a like a happy byproduct of that enjoyable time spent together, I guess.
I can see that. And there was times where, you know, obviously when we started this podcast stuff, I was doing online schooling as a teacher and I could not stand staring at my computer anymore. And people were like, let's play games online. Let's do this. Let's do that. And I was like, nah, I can't do it. Like, even though that was like your one way of communicating with the outside world and chatting to like Mike or whoever, I was like, nah, I couldn't do it. Whereas now, I'm more than happy to jump online and play games because I don't have that overstimulation of staring at the screen. So I can sympathize a lot with you there, Matt, about just getting screen burnout.
I wanted to mention as well, like talking about some of the other games that I've played and I've really enjoyed. You got My Shelfie that came out not too long ago, which was another fantastic game, and it brought back the childhood memories of playing Connect Four by, you know, dropping pieces down one of that shelf. Speaking of Next Station London, I call it the Ghostbusters mechanic where you can't cross the streams, you can't go over your lines and stuff. You know, like I really do enjoy these sort of mechanics you bring into the hobby and changing things up a bit. Is that usually like little things like the Connect Four? I call it the Connect Four. It's not really a mechanic; it's just sort of the way you play the game. But that game could have easily been tiles in front of you. You know what I mean? Without the whole 3D aspect of it. These sort of ideas, have they been things that have been coming, helping with, you know, collaborating with the other designers, or have you had these sort of ideas going into it? How have they come about?
Well, actually, with My Shelfie, I mean, that's down to, of course, the, you know, the better Australian designer, Phil Walker-Harding, who deigned to collaborate with me. Like, you know, was happy to take on an apprentice, and I'm very thankful to him. And he actually, the original prototype was dropping marbles into test tubes. And they were physical, you know, three-dimensional, and you would be dropping them in. So it had that kind of theme. But I mean, the mechanisms were broadly similar. But I think he and I think we agree. Like, I think having that, you have to have a bit of that product idea in mind, the aesthetic of a game and table presence. And I think it can elevate, especially for games like that, which are trying to reach a sort of like wider audience, you know, slightly mass market sort of thing. It really makes a difference having that kind of toyetic kind of feel to the game, or that nostalgia. But also part of that also has to come down to Cranio, the publisher, who, you know, changed the theme from that kind of like test tube thing. And they were the ones who really saw the kind of My Shelfie Kallax-esque kind of, you know, grid in front of the players. And I think they just really nailed it with that kind of that aesthetic effectively. And
the aesthetic
really
worked.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Sorry. Yeah.
I I had the honor of getting a prototype copy of it, and I took it to PAX last year.
Oh.
And mate, everyone wanted to play the cat game. Everyone wanted to play the game that looked like Connect Four, and I happily taught it 10 times in a row. And I was still having a great time, but yeah. Mate, everyone wanted to try it because once again, it brings back that feel of your childhood, and it looks appealing on the table, and it's a game that you're going to walk past, and people are going to see and go, "Well, I want to try that. It looks really cool." And you know, having the little board games pictures on there and stuff was really nice as well, and I did a really good job, man.
Thank you for demoing it then. Thank you.
Yeah, Mike was like MVP of PAX with the amount of my shelving that he taught. It was like you would sort of like turn around and see he's teaching like one group of people, then go and like do your own thing and turn back the other way, and then turn around, he's teaching like another bunch of four people. You're like, what, did you even have a break? You're like, I'll get your coffee, I'll get your Red Bull, whatever you need. But along with your Spiljaras nomination, you've also, the last sort of 2 years since we've spoken to you, started Postmark Games, which is a really, really cool initiative. You discussed potentially doing this last time you're on the show. Can you maybe tell our audience like what that's about and then how the journey's been? Because you've released three really, really cool, kind of similar in DNA-ish games, but also like really different in their own ways. So I think our audience would be super interested to hear a bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah. No. It's actually, I guess you've kind of, we probably just spoke before it really all came together. So yeah. So Postmark Games, it's a company that we focus on print at home or print at play games, and they're games where we send you the files and you print off. Usually there's just a single A4 sheet of paper that you print off at home. You need one sheet per player, and you'll use at the moment a certain number of dice, either 1, 2, or 3, depending on which game you're playing. And that's all you need, and a pencil or writing implement. And it came about sort of mid-pandemic. A lot of Kickstarters were having problems fulfilling. Listeners of the podcast might know that I have a rather popular Kickstarter which hasn't fulfilled yet, so don't hold me accountable, but it's coming. And with Rory Muldoon, who is the kind of co-founder of Postmark Games, really talented game designer and illustrator and graphic designer based in the UK. We hadn't met in real life. He had kind of stalked me when I did some streaming during the pandemic. And I had kind of stalked him also. He had sort of taken part in this online game jam with Michael Fox on his stream. And I'd seen the game that he'd made that would become Voyages, which was the first game that Postmark Games made. And I was like, oh, this game's amazing. And I kind of reached out and saying like, oh, here's some ideas what I think you could do with the game, how you could develop it. No idea that like, you know, it was just me saying like, here are some ideas, you know, you're the designer. But kind of from that and some other conversations, we were kind of both saying that we kind of wanted to explore games that we both enjoyed, like smaller footprint games, but we felt that they were very difficult to sell to publishers in a way. And we kind of wanted to explore, and we're sort of like, well, we could make these games ourselves, but we both also agreed that we didn't want to be publishers and that we didn't want to have to worry about fulfillment or printing or shipping, or like I have no interest in that. Rory definitely has no interest in that. And so we came up with Postmark, which was basically to do all the fun stuff about being a publisher, making the game, you know, doing the graphics, etc., without any of the stuff we didn't want to do. And we had our first Kickstarter for Voyages, which was our first game, in November, December 2021. And it went, we had a goal of, I don't know if the goal was like £500, I think. Like, you know, we were sort of like, let's put the goal at £500. If we get 1,000, even £2,000, you know, because the game costs £4. So we're like, oh, 500 backers, that would be amazing. You know, like that would far exceed. And of course, you know, it was like, would have it, we end up with like 13,000 backers and made like, you know, £50,000, which was sort of kind of ridiculous. And kind of from there, like, it, you know, it's just sort of kept going. And now we've sort of built up this line of games, which not only have that kind of print home aesthetic, but I think have their own kind of DNA of sort of low interaction games. We, you know, kind of being born of the pandemic, they're games which can be played over stream, or, you know, like if you're not in the same place, can be played with a big crowd of people. Rory, you know, I mean, when you have an incredibly talented graphic designer, illustrator, We've talked about Ian O'Toole. I think Rory is like should be talked about in the same echelons of someone like Ian. And I don't say that lightly because I hold Ian as a huge, amazing talent in the industry. But when you have someone like Rory in your company, then we're really about how do you make something that's really beautiful before you play it, and how do you make something that's beautiful when you finish playing it. And I like to think that we've been able to kind of do that in our games. And the other really nice thing out of all of that is that we've had a really nice community grow up around the games. There's a lot of because we've kind of released kind of assets packs for our games. You know, like we have people who make their own community maps. Which what I didn't mention actually is for all of our games, because the other thing about Print Home is we can keep releasing content kind of for free, mm-hmm. kind of like DLC in video games. So, you know, when you pledge for one of our games, you get all the content we're ever going to release for it. So we often, you know, so far for Voyages, we've had 5 maps, a campaign mode. And, you know, when you first pledge, you got like 1 or 2 maps, but you've got all that extra stuff for free, basically, from that initial pledge, or if you buy it from our website. So I like to think we've kind of leveraged, you know, what's possible in this kind of different way of doing things. Actually, you're talking to us to me. We're about to have a kind of an announcement of a new game in about a week, which I can't say at the moment. But it is actually going to be the first post-bug game that's not designed by Rory and myself. We're actually partnering with another well-known designer who may have done a quite famous World War II based deck building game. Makes it print home things.
Just blink. Don't say anything. Is it Dave Thompson?
We may or may not. Yes, maybe.
That's really exciting, man. That's so cool. And thanks for just dropping that casually on the show as well.
So we're kind of branching out a little bit in terms of what we're doing, and because I think that it's funny actually. We were talking the other day about this idea of like a collab. What's the word? Not collaborative. Like co-op. What do you call flat out games? Like the people who made Point Cell, they have a name for what their model is. But it's like it's more of a model where lots of creatives come together and kind of share in the process. It's not like a publisher designer relationship.
It's almost like a cooperative, not like a cooperative game.
Exactly.
Like an old farmers co-op where the farmers would come together and give their wares off.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think we're sort of thinking like Postmark could have some aspect that's a bit like that, because we have the kind of we've built up the way of doing it it's great to work with other creatives who have that kind of same, you know, to bring that kind of different form factor to kind of games and share it with our audience. So, we've been really, really fortunate. There are some things we don't really know much about, like marketing and running a business in some ways, but we've been really like not knocked back by just the kind of like really amazing support that we've gotten from the community. So we've been very fortunate.
Everyone I talk to just says how great they are and what a great idea it is that you effectively get a game sent to inbox. Like it's just such a clever way of doing things. I just thought it was a really cool idea. And like I said, we get on our Discord, people are always talking about, you know, Voyages in particular and all that type of stuff. So yeah, congratulations to both you and Rory.
Thank you.
Backing off your answer there and explaining that sort of process of Voyages, circling around to a question from one of our community members, Jace. You've answered some of the question already, but he asked, what are Matt's thoughts and learnings from doing Postmark one-pager print-and-play games, the pros and cons of direct-to-customer and low-overhead model as opposed to the more traditional sort of way of releasing games?
It's a good question. Obviously, I covered a few of the pros. Like you kind of miss a lot of the headache around fulfillment, and you have no overhead costs and these sort of things. But of course, there are some negatives. You know, like people aren't going to discover the games by walking past them in a shop. You know, there is no box, there is no physical presence. Even really, like, even if you saw somebody play at a convention, they haven't got a box sitting by them, you know, you'd really have to kind of pay attention. So in terms of, like, discovering the games, it's all by kind of word of mouth, online. And as I said, like, we're not very, very good marketers. It takes a different kind of skill set to kind of sell, not even sell the game, really just tell people about it. And you know, we've done a lot to try and reduce the barrier to print and play, like, to, because there are segments of print play that are, I think, very into the kind of crafting aspect of print play. You know, like, they love, like, making 300 tokens and 200 cards and, you know, redoing Terraforming Mars or whatever. But we're very much interested in the kind of other, like, the very much the other end of that, which is, like, what is the literally the least you can do in order to enjoy a print and hope game? Like, print off one A4 piece of paper that you don't have to do any cutting. It's just an A4 piece of paper. In order to try and bring as many people into that, you know, who might have been, you know, worried about it or just apprehensive of it. I think the other, I mean, you know, you are limited. It's both a pro and con in that it kind of limits the kind of games you can make. I think it's actually a good thing because I think, you know, some constraints is really a really useful way to guide design. I think it's a great way to come up with inventive solutions to problems and to come up with new things. But of course it means you can't make your, you know, 90 minute euro, you know, it's just a different kind of undertaking. So, but overall I would say I see many more pros, you know, and I think we've seen like other companies and other designers follow us and do the same thing. And that's really great as well. I love that it's also been available. I remember there was a Vietnamese designer who had seen our Voyages Kickstarter, was a backer and was inspired then to do their own Kickstarter. I think this game was called Shoes Tactics. Awesome. And of course that it's you know, from those countries which don't have the same access maybe to big publishers or publishing or even if they wanted to be a publisher, it would be much more expensive. That's really great. Like, I think that's just, it's helping more and more people be game designers and share their, you know, like the great thing about digital game design in some ways is that not anyone, but if you can make the game, you can then share it. It's not, that's not an extra step. You know, you can put it on itch.io or do any of these game jams, you know, and you can have these indie breakout hits or you can share your craft. It's just so much harder in tabletop to do that. And I think it gives people who are interested in design that ability to then go like, oh yeah, I can do that and I can share it. So I love that it can bring new people into the hobby, but also into the kind of design aspect of it as well.
Cool. I've got a question from Jonathan, and he's actually talking about Elysium. So he says, I'd love to know how that he came up with the mechanism in Elysium to choose cards by using the pillars. It's almost like reverse worker placement.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
In that you are gradually taken away. Elysium is also an underrated game, but does Matt think that there is a particular game of his that is the best or most underrated? So he's asking to be your favorite child, let's face it.
Yeah, well, it's the most, it's like your what is it, like the least favorite child, not just like the, you know, like which is the one that, you know, should get more love from the world or something like that. I mean, first to Elysium, actually, interestingly enough, that originally the design was kind of even more complicated. You actually had four colored dice, not columns, and you would roll these dice, and you needed a combination of colors and symbols that you would get from the dice. And thankfully, during the development, it simplified to just the colors. I think it's been a while since we made it, so I don't know if I know exactly the kind of breakthrough, but what I do like about it is that it asks you to make decisions at each point of the road, but it narrows down the decisions. Actually, it's funny that you say reverse worker placement, because I think it's actually kind of similar to worker placement in the same sense that your decision space is narrowing as the round goes on, much like worker placement or traditional worker placement where you have fewer spots as you go on. And this is sort of like you have to, there's that little in-between bit of like randomness and control, because you sort of see what's out there. You can't control what the other players might do, but you have that like glimpse of like, oh, if I get away the, you know, if I give away this color column, then I can take this, then I give away this color. So you can plan, But there's a bit of randomness in the middle of that. So that mechanism kind of serves that purpose really well. I'd love to say I remember this huge aha moment, but that game went through so many different versions, and like wildly different versions. Like it used to be like a kind of like a huge RPG game, and then it was a Euro style game, and it had these dice with this common thing throughout the whole thing, and then it finally kind of landed like, you know, a year later on that what would become Elysium. So I don't know if there was like this like one moment where we figured it out, but thankfully we got there in the end. In terms of underrated games, I don't think Elysium is actually that underrated in a way, because I would say it's one of the more active, like, for example, on Board Game Geek, like, if you look at a game that's now, you know, getting on, you know, what is it, 8 years old, like, the fact that you get a post every now and then is, like, far beyond games of a similar age. And Space Cowboys is aware of that. They know that. I should say the other, I can say that there may be another game in not exactly, but of a simplified nature within the Elysium universe that may or may not be being released in the next, you know, year or so.
Matt, I love that you're not the best at keeping secrets. This is very good.
He's not telling us anything specific, Connor. Yeah. Okay. He's not being specific. It may or may not be things.
It may or may not. But so we haven't forgotten it, and it's it remains something that is kind of close to us. If I had to think of a game, I think of a game actually. Well, there's a couple. One is Costa Rica. It was a game that was released from Lookout. I want to say 7 years ago. So, no, I don't know. Quite a while ago. It's a sort of a family push your luck tile game. I think the difficulty with the game was that Lookout is not known for like their family weight. You know, like they're the people who do Agricola. You know, they're known for a certain thing, and I think there was probably a bit of a mismatch, but I think the game is sort of like, it's like a classic push your luck. I'm thinking of what's the island game? No, the gold. What's it called? What's the classic Bruno Faduti push your luck game? Ink and Gold. It's like a geographic.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like a geographical Ink and Gold, basically, kind of.
Okay.
In the sense that.
Okay.
So it's like Ink and Gold, but where you can also screw over your friends by
cutting off
of expeditions.
That doesn't seem like Mark's top again.
Yeah, it is.
I think it is just one of those like very clear, simple kind of family games, but I think it just didn't quite, like the kind of product thing didn't work. So I hope that we'll see a thing. And the other game I would say is Roll for Adventure, which was from Cosmos. And it was a dice-rolling cooperative game. And it's kind of like Yahtzee cooperative, kind of like chucking lots of dice. And I really liked the game, but it just didn't quite, you know, for whatever reason, didn't quite hit the mark. So, yeah, I'd say those two games.
Cool.
There you go,
cool,
folks. Try to get them played, guys, and let us know if you have played them and what you think about them. But wrapping up from our community questions, Draven, our friend James, has asked a question I also wanted to ask as well. He said the Guild of Merchant Explorers is one of the favorites in their house, but wants to know, are you working on any other guilds?
Do you mean it, like expansions to it? Or
yes, to all.
Because there is only one guild. There is only one Guild of Merchant Explorers, isn't there? And they're somewhat sort of amorphous in that we don't really know exactly what they do.
They just travel. They like to see things.
They just like we don't ask any questions about what they do. They just like to see things. You know, we'll see. I personally hope so, but you know, it's not completely down to me. But yeah, we definitely designed that game. It's kind of funny. Like, I look back on it and I kind of wish, not wish, I mean, I wish it was a postmark game because, you know, I would love to, you know, we have ideas to make new maps and new, I think that system is very versatile. So I hope so. But I'm not sure, I guess is the point at this point.
Sorry? We'd love to see it though if it does happen.
Yes, we would.
Yeah, fingers crossed here too, don't worry.
Thank you so much for the chat, Matt. Would you like to join us in talking about some other games as well and what we've been playing?
Let's do it.
Sounds like a plan. Condog, hit us off, man. What have you been playing?
What have I been playing? So the other week, I went home to visit my family and I introduced them to two smaller card games. One that is like, both of them actually are board game barbecue darlings, right? One is Six Nimmt. That I pronounce differently every time, and that blew their mind. They just couldn't quite, like, Grok's like, wait, where am I putting this card? Where am I putting this card? Why are you putting it there? Why am I taking so many cards? And why are these cards worth more? They're all the same. So that whole process was really, really fun. If you haven't played 16 before, it's really, really straightforward but chaotic card game that becomes even more mental once you add more players in. Because what happens is you choose a card to play each turn, and you all choose it simultaneously. So you go 1, 2, 3, and you show. Do you say something? Are you supposed to say something when you place the card, Mike?
I think so. You should. No, I thought,
yeah, move. Maybe we should move. like a kung fu fighting sound or something. And then you place the cards on an array of four different rows based on their order, starting with the lowest card and then ending up with the highest. But if your card gets placed in a row that has five cards already, you have to take the entire row. But the good part is that if you can't place a card in a row because it's too low, you can then replace any other row with that card you want. So if, for example, you're like, oh, the lowest card is 9 and I've got a 1, well, you might want to place that 1 and then just take that 9, because 9 actually isn't worth that many points. The cards that are worth the most amount of points are the 5s, the 11s, and is that it? Are they the only ones that are worth, like, special points, I think, off the top of my head?
It's like all the double numbers, isn't it? Isn't it like the 11, 22, 33? I think they're really dodgy numbers from memory.
So you don't want them. Anyway, it's really fun, and I'm sure lots of people have played it before, so I won't belabor the point too much. But they really liked it, but they didn't like it as much as Scout. So Scout was an interesting little, I guess, my family hadn't played a lot of ladder climbers, trick takers, and all that type of stuff that Scout kind of falls into, like, you know, getting rid of your hand and all that type of stuff. And when I explained it, they're like, yep, okay, this makes sense. All right, I'm kind of understanding, like, what beats what and then what I need to form. And I said, oh, yeah, by the way, you cannot move the cards around in your hand once the game begins. In fact, at all. And they were like, what? How am I supposed to play this? How am I even supposed to, like, it, not get negative points? And we started with myself, mum, my sister, and her oldest daughter. And then by the end, her youngest daughter was actually playing by herself and making her own decisions. And what they did, because I sent a message to Sarah saying, I'm going to play Scout with my family. She's like, oh, I think they'll really like it. Audrey and Elsie had made these little tickets that said, me, Mars, help token, so they could go to my mum and be like, me, Ma, I need a hand, can you help me? And so then mum would help them. And I don't know, like, they went to mum because mum seemed like she knew what she was doing, which was pretty good. But like, of all the people in our family, like, it's normally mum that's asking the most amount of questions, like the one that's like, so what do I do again on my turn and all that stuff. So yeah, that was really, really cool. I just thought I'd take some easy card, not easy, but some lighter card games home, because I generally, you know, I'll get a big box game like an Endless Winter or a Distilled or something like that. I'm like, oh, this is so cool, I'm going to take this home and we'll have this big afternoon. But we didn't really have that opportunity that time. So it was nice. So yeah, I got to play that with my family. What about you, Mike? What have you been playing lately?
I've been playing a bunch of games since we last played. I was really trying to ramp up my gameplay because I was trying to go for my most games played in a month.
That's
I'm
right.
not going to get there. I did the math today. I need to play 8.25 games every day until the end of August to smash out my record. So I don't think it's going to happen.
Just get some postmark games. Just play heaps of postmark games. You'll be fine.
That's what I should do. I'm up to like 62, 63 plays this month, I think. I was trying to get there, but it's all right. I want to hit 100. I want to get 100 games in a month played. Not different games, just 100 plays of games, but it's okay. I want to start this game just with a small story. It won't take too long, but when I first joined the hobby and I got into the game group that I now run, I met two guys, so I'm now very good friends with Tom and Alex. And Tom and Alex thought it'd be a great idea to invite this new guy to the hobby who didn't know what a worker placement was to play Underwater Cities. And I just remember picking up my brain from the table after the game. I had no idea what was going on, had no idea. And since playing Underwater Cities all the way back then, I didn't really have an opinion because I was so new to everything. I was just pretending like I had some idea what I was doing. The game's by Vladimir Succi, and since then I've fallen in love with a bunch of his games and Legacy. I've fallen in love with his games, but I'm forgetting what they're called. He's got a bunch of them. I was just trying to say Last Will. I always get Legacy and Last Will confused because they share things. But Praga, Pulsar, all these games I've really, really enjoyed. And so today I went over to their house. I said, can we get out Underwater Cities again? I want to try this game again just to now I understand what's going on. I want to see how it goes. And these two boys are nearly impossible to beat in games. If you can beat one of them, amazing. If you can beat both, you're doing amazing. But there's something about Vladimir Succi's games. Like, I don't always think I love Euros, but I don't think I'm that great at them. But there's something about his games that I can just see the path I want to take, which is really rare in a lot of these big games for me. And it gets me excited. And they were laughing at me because I had such a serious face on the whole game because I was really concentrating on my moves. And for those who haven't played it, Def's spoken about it. Def loves this game. But Underwater Cities, you're sort of building a tableau of cards as you play that sort of are strengthening your abilities. But you get to add these cards to your ability if you play a worker placement spot of the same color as the card. So they sort of work together. So you're sort of getting led into what worker placement space you want to take by playing the sort of similar card. And you're building out this beautiful board of an underwater city. You're building little dome cities with adjoining roads under the ground and little
laboratories around them.
Ways of getting points. I won't go into it too deeply, but it's so satisfying watching your city grow, playing these cards, seeing what combos you get, and the whole game, I was nearly double the amount of points from everyone. Of course, everyone caught up to me, but end of game points, I beat Alex, which is nearly impossible, but Tom got me by 1 point. I was happy and upset at the same time, but it was really satisfying to be a competitor with these guys because usually I'm super far behind. But it just brought back to me because I think Underwater Cities is one of Succi's like most popular games. And I was like, man, I love this guy's games, but I haven't really played his best one since I've been a proper gamer. And man, it was just so satisfying. And I posted it today on our Facebook page. And we've gotten a bunch of people saying it's such an underrated game. I love this game. It's such a go-to game. If you haven't played Underwater Cities, I highly suggest you give it a crack.
It was so good. I love this game so much. Oh, it's so fun.
And they've got deluxe pieces for it. So all the pieces are little 3D models and, beautiful.
It goes, you can get really nice from BGG. You can get the nice money. So each time I've been like, and the pieces that you get too. Yeah, that's right. So the tokens, so you get the kelp or the algae and stuff like that. It's so good. And the whole action of you have to play a card and play the worker spot, but you can ignore one to play the other. Like it's really, really clever. That dual use card is fantastic. And then having them there, the theme as well, just having that, being a marine biologist, I just love having like that underwater theme and then the science thrown in. It always gets compared to Terraforming Mars as well. And for me, I would play this over Terraforming Mars.
I don't see the comparison.
It's a tableau building. It's that side of thing and the combos and stuff like that. But yeah, in the different ages, you go through the different ages, the cards become more powerful. But when you posted that today, I had so much jealousy because I was like, I wish I was there and played it with you. I just wanted to play another game of it. But I think I'm actually going up to Queensland soon to see Def for his birthday. Yep. I reckon we might get a sneaky game of Underwater Cities. It's just a hunch.
You got to do it. Have you had a chance to play any of these games spoken about so far, Matt?
I have. This is where I get to show off my nascent Czech, because I'm not sure if you know, but my wife is Czech and I have learned Czech. It's Succi.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I've been corrected.
Actually, It kind of knows. It means dry in Czech, strangely enough. But
just, underwater.
If Vladimir ever that's the other thing, because the other kind of famous Czech designer, Vladimir Švatil. It's like one of these unpronounceable CH in Czech. Sorry, we're now going in a weird rabbit hole, but CH next to each other in Czech is in fact a letter, a single letter. And it's like the CH in lock. That's how you pronounce CH. So, yeah, anyway. So Švatil is like Švatil, or like I'm not even doing it completely correct. Anyway. But yes, I love Underwater Suki. It's a fantastic game. And I completely agree that Suki's games are, I think he's a really, like a very consistent designer in terms of like, has it made like a huge number of games? Like it's not like hundreds, but they're all very good. Like I think, and I'm really glad how he, because that's his own company, Delicious Games. You know, that like he started making his own games, and I'm really glad that that's kind of been a successful kind of pursuit for him. Because, you know, it doesn't always happen that, you know, when designers make their own games and they, you know, it's a different thing running a company. But yeah, no, I'm a sucker for any kind of like card based Euro game. Like some of my favorite games are like the more Italian, like Lorenzo Il Magnifico and Grand Austria Hotel and things like this. So, big fan of, and Scout is like, I'm sad that it didn't win the Spiel des Jahres myself, but I knew it probably wouldn't. But no, I have a copy not that far away from me here. But I love playing that very much.
Have you played anything lately, Matt, that you would want to talk about?
Well, this is it's going to sound a bit a lot of prototypes. But then the other thing is, I'm going to say one of my own games. I'm sorry, but my games was released in Berlin, and it's funny, Connor, that you were talking about playing with your family, because my parents are very kind of supportive of what I do, but from the sense of, well, I was a scientist before this, and it's a similar sort of level of comprehension of what, you know, is actually going on in a way, and so they haven't played a lot of my games, but this most recent game, which is called Pray Another Day, or in German it's called Schnitzeljagd, it's a very simple kind of bluffing game that just got released from Edition Spielwisse in Berlin, and I think it'll be coming out in English soon. It's a game where every player has five cards. Everyone has the same hand, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You have a bear, that's the number one, all the way through to a mouse, which is number five. And the idea is you're hunting each other, and you have to kind of survive each round. And each round that you survive, you get some food, and it's the first to get a certain amount of food wins. You all place a card face down at the same time, a bit like Six Nimmt. And then you start at the number one, at the bear, and you ask, has anyone played a bear? And if anyone has played a bear, they reveal that. And if they're the only one who played the bear, then they get to hunt one other animal. So they say, cool. I want to hunt all the lynxes, or the threes, for example. So I'm going to hunt all the lynxes. Anyone else who's played a lynx would then have to reveal that, and they're out of the round. They got eliminated.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
And then we'd keep going down, like who's played a number two, etc. The other thing is if two players had played a bear at the same time, they're still fine. They don't get hunted, but they get in each other's way, and they don't get to hunt any other animal. Once we get to the end of, you know, everyone's revealed cards or got eliminated, then you'll play another card face down, whoever's still in the round. So, like, if I'd played a bear in the first round, I'm going to have to choose another card, and I leave the bear face up in front of me. And so then the kind of options of trying to guess what other people's played is get narrows and narrows and narrows. You keep doing that until either everyone's out and one player's left and they get some food, or you've each played three cards, and then whoever has the highest sum of cards in front of them. So there's an advantage trying to play the weaker cards, mm-hmm. because they'll help you win at the end. And that's it. That's all game, you know. And then you gather up all your cards, play another round, and you're just trying to be the first to get a certain number of food. And it's the first game of mine I've played with my parents. I can't even remember how long, like, you know, like in an extremely long time, basically, which was a really nice experience, because, you know, and actually I think my mother won, which was sort of you know, like she enjoyed that quite a bit. So that was like quite a special experience for me.
That's great.
Not that, you know, just to be able to share that with them. So yeah, that was kind of experience. And then the other ones are just prototypes, which I can't. I've been pretty forthcoming with information, but I can't be that forthcoming with some of this information.
Well, we get it. We get it. It's okay. You know, you've got a livelihood to look after, so that's all well and good with us.
Conduct. What else are you getting to tell, man?
So, I'm going to do something a little bit naughty today. Oh. I'm going to mention a game. It's my sizzling game. And it's actually going to be a video game. But it's a card-based video game called Inscription. So this game called Inscription is a card game. It's also what they call a roguelite, which means that when you die, you have a little bit of saved progress, but you've got to start from the beginning and then go again. So you start the game in Inscription in a, effectively, you load up the game and then you're taken straight to the table and you learn the game. And the game is it starts off seeming like a fairly simple card battler, but in the end, you end up having these complex scenarios and combos and then more and more advanced individuals. So what you do is you have this deck of cards. It starts off really simply to start with. So you start off with four, let's call them unique cards that can deal damage to your opponent. And then you have these squirrel cards. So these squirrel cards are effectively your resources. They're your mana, because in order to summon any of these more dangerous animals like the stoat, the stink bug that you end up getting, you know, at one point you can get great white sharks. And then there's like stranger. Like, so there was one that I got, which was, it started off as a pupa, then turned into the chrysalis, and then turned into the mothman, which the mothman could do like 7 damage, which is a lot. So it's got this really, really weird kind of horror aesthetic. And you're not really sure what to think of it when it begins. And then, so you're going through and you're playing, and if you've ever played a game called Slay the Spire, it's very, very similar in that you're working your way up these challenges and then fighting these bosses. But what happens is that each time you're defeated, and you will get defeated, the person who you're fighting against, who is at the same time telling this story, they then capture a picture of your visage, and you can use some of the cards that were left in your deck to sort of power those cards up and get different abilities. So I haven't even explained like the base concept of this game yet. So you're playing cards and your aim is to effectively out damage your opponent, but there's a scale system. So for example, you have to deal, you know, cumulatively 7 more damage than your opponent has dealt to you over a series of turns. But you can sort of like, you know, it could be a bit of push and shove, push and pull of like, all right, let them damage me for a bit and then I'll come back and damage it, damage them. And then hopefully you've built up this chain of cards. And there's abilities that lots of people who have played card battlers will be familiar with. There's like blockers, there's flyers, so they can jump over your defense. You can have ones that just have really high defense, so they act as a wall. But then there's also these weird cards that you get as well. So, for example, you can get like a caged wolf. So the caged wolf, it can take damage. It can't attack back. But then once the caged wolf has been defeated, the wolf is then let free. So you then have a wolf that can go and attack your opponent. All the while, you're also playing more of a video game where you're searching around this cabin that you're trapped in, trying to sort of solve the mystery of who this person is that you're playing and so on and so forth. And it's this really creepy aesthetic of this guy who plays against you. He kind of looks a little bit wild and creepy. Once you get to a certain point, you kind of see what he looks like. But the reason I'm talking about it is that the card play itself is really, really good. So it's got this whole mystery side of things as well, which would be awesome. But the card play is really, really fun and really engaging, and you have to really work really hard to work out the puzzles because it's obviously automated, right? Like you're playing against a computer, so there's a system that you can use. There's a hint of randomness, but you can power up your cards by sacrificing them and then adding that power to another card so you can end up with these cool card combos. I ended up having it won me the portion of the game, because anytime my squirrels are sacrificed, they came back to my hand. So I effectively had this limitless source of power to be able to summon these more and more powerful our enemies. And you've also got these side powers. So, for example, you can use some scissors to like cut the opponent's card so that it's not there anymore, like it was too powerful. You have like a break in case of emergency, like squirrels or other things. So it's like, oh, I really need some power. I'll break in case of emergency. A few more morbid things that you might use, like I won't go into it too much, but I'm not going to say any more because it is really interesting. There's a point in the game where it just goes off the rails. And if you've played it, you'll know exactly the point I'm talking about. Okay. But then it turns into, it still has the same mechanic, the card battling mechanic, but the game itself just, yeah. Anyway, I won't say anymore. Have Mike, judging by like you're nodding and you haven't played it. Matt, have you seen or played this game before?
I've played the first level, I didn't get into it, so
yeah.
I know of it.
It took over my life this weekend, which is what I'm like the only thing I really have to talk about is a card game. But yeah, I feel like I'm cheating a bit because I'm talking about a game that I played on the PlayStation, but it is a card game, and I've done this before with Marvel Snap. It's not a card game that you and me could sit down and play, Mike, because of the way that the video game mechanics are worked into it. And plus, you've obviously got the story on the side about working out who you are and why you're there and all that type of stuff that you kind of get thrown into. But yeah, there's this real moment of like, holy, you know what am I playing again? Like, is this for real? So yeah, if you've got some time, if you like card battlers, if you like games that are a little bit, subverting expectations, definitely give Inscription a look in because it is well worth your time and it's well worth playing just for the card mechanic itself.
Apart from like you playing against this weird creeper dude that we'll just call Mitch, can you see this game like translating into like a board game, card game that could like PvP with someone?
You could do that, yes. There's a part in the game where it sort of they allude to something like that. Okay. But I can't say anymore without giving it. It's kind of like sizzling a legacy game or a campaign game. You don't want to talk about it too much because you don't want to spoil it for people. And I don't know if I've spoiled too much. The only thing I'll say is that it could have legs as to, if it was a Yu-Gi-Oh type of game, which it's clearly taken inspiration from, or Magic or Pokemon, it's clearly taken inspiration from those, but it's also got that Slay the Spire type going up the track mechanic. And then the other one that it's kind of, I think, half inspired by is Hand of Fate, which itself was a video game that was based on cards that then became a board game, I think, which is kind of funny. I think, was that made by Australian? I feel like it's
got a hint. Australian publisher, Ruler Make, was the way we did that.
Yeah, yeah. So there we go. There's a link there. But yeah, Inscription, if you have a PlayStation Plus account, you can play it as part of that, and that's why I got it. But even if it's like $10 or something, grab it. I think it's on like the Switch as well. So yeah, that's my sizzling game for the week is a card game that you don't actually play on the table. So Inscription.
Cool. I'll mention two things, including my sizzle. I just want to mention quickly, I played Cicadian's First Light. It wasn't my first play of it, but when I played it last time, like over a year ago, it didn't really hit me. I don't remember much about the game that I played, but I remember like, yeah, it was okay. And it didn't really do much for me. But Joe from our community, I went over his place to play some games. They pulled it out. I said, look, let's give it a second go. I'm definitely a person that likes to give games a second go. And hit me completely opposite way this time. Loved it. Had a great game. It's a dice placement game, so kind of like worker placement, but you're rolling a bunch of dice. But the thing that I found really interesting about it is that you're sort of getting a lot of resources in the game, so you're rolling your dice behind a screen and allocating them if you're going to try to farm certain resources or if you've got to sort of put them in an area that's saying, I'm going to launch these dice into the worker placement area. But the more dice you put on there, you start to have to pay more cost in, kelp because of that. It was a little seaweed or something? Or some greenery?
It's something from the planet it's on. Yeah.
Green stuff. You have to pay more of this resource to place your dice out. And so you're sort of trying to manage all your resources and get your dice out to gain more points and do all these things. But your dice, essentially in two main parts of the game, get locked away to get points. So it's a bit of a rush to complete certain goals, put your dice in this area, pay a bunch of resources to sort of lock your space in, get access to a special power, and get a bunch of end game points. So it's got a really cool mechanic where in this main part of the game where you're trying to lock dice in, you can only put 5 or 6 dice in each area. But there's these sort of rewards for being the first people to do something. So if you're the first person to play a 1 in an area, you can get a reward for it. If you're the first person to play a 2 in an area, you can get a reward for it. But then as you get all these rewards, these negatives come through. So in the 3 main areas you're trying to place dice, if you're the first person to add a 2nd of the same number, you get a consequence for it. And you have to lose a resource or lose a worker die. But once you put your die in these areas, they get locked away. So there's ways of getting more dice workers throughout the game, which isn't super easy or super cheap. But then as you're getting these more dice, you then have to lock them away to lock in these more points. So you're constantly getting more and less workers, and you never have quite enough you need to do all the shots you want to do, or someone's taking your spots. And it was a really great game, and I'm really glad I gave it a second try, because I think sometimes, depending on the teach that you had or the mood that you're in, or maybe your level of expertise, like how many games you played of a similar nature at the time, I think coming back to games after a while can make such a big difference, because it did for me in this game, and it's happened to me with a lot of games. Like Underwater Cities is another one where I hadn't played it for so long, and it was a hard experience being so new to games. But now that I'm a gamer and I've played many more, I learned it really quickly and had a really good time sort of knowing what I was doing. So that was really cool. I won't go on about it too much, but that was Circadian's First Light. My Sizzling Game is a quick, small game that just came out of Kickstarter. I'm kicking myself that I didn't back it, because I was eyeing it off at the time. It's a little tile placement game called Junk Draw. Have either of you guys had a chance to play or heard about it much?
No,
yet?
But I saw you wanting to. You've got a copy of Junk Draw for
straight away. I've now pre-ordered a copy, so it's coming, and my friend sent me his copy. But this is a game that a game can go for 10 minutes, maybe 15. And it reminds me a lot of, without being a flippin' right, it reminds me a lot of Cartographers. If you've liked Cartographers, this is almost like a super quick, super light version of it. It's similar but not the same. So it's a polyomino game using Tetris-style pieces,
games, Mike.
I'm so upset I didn't back it. I'm so upset. But the theme is you're scrummaging through a junk drawer, one of your drawers at home. We all have one that's full of just random crap. Yeah, USBs and old pencils and a necklace and
currency
measuring
from
paper,
other countries,
all that sort of stuff. Coins are in there as well. And so everyone starts the game having the exact. It reminds me of one of your games, Matt, because it's one of those games where everyone has the same choice, and depending how you make those choices, sort of you branch off into your own little sort of categories. But you have all these pieces of all different shapes and sizes, and in front of you, you've got 4 squares. I want to say they're each 5x5 squares, and there's a red, green, blue, purple, I think. And in the middle of the table are 4 objectives for each square. So square number 1 on the top left might be you're going to get 1 point for every empty square on the edge of your board. And number 2 might be the opposite. It might be I'm going to get a point for each covered square. Number 3 might be something like, what was the other ones we did? We did a hard one, which was get 1 point for each column or row that only has 2 squares covered. So as soon as you cover 3, you don't get to score, which is really hard to do. But all these different sort of objectives. And these objectives are coming from a big wad of different objectives you can choose from, labeled easy, medium, or hard. So you can play a complete easy game, or we played one game with 1 easy, 2 medium, and a hard, just to mix it up a little bit. And the way the game plays is super, super simple. You're going to flip over a card, and that's going to show one of the items. Let's say it's keys. And everyone has to grab their keys, and they put it in one of those 4 squares, going to one of those 4 goals. And you're going to do that 3 more times. But every time, you can't place one of those pieces where a piece is already gone. You have to put 1 in each area, which gets really frustrating, because you might get that 1 perfect piece for one of those areas, but if you already put a piece in there this round, you don't get to put it in there again. And you keep going every round, shuffle the cards up, you actually don't shuffle them up because you put the same pieces back in. You keep going through, bring out 4 cards every round. But by the 4th or the 5th round, there's such small squares that you're filling in. As soon as somebody can't put a piece in an area they're forced to, the game's over.
Yeah, for everyone.
For everyone.
Oh,
okay. So it was really funny. We played one game where one of the, I think, goals were you get, I think, a point for every just empty point in the whole square. And I stuffed up and I got stuck in one point where I had to end the game like in the end of the second round. And everyone was telling me off because they thought I, not cheated, they thought I tricked them all because I barely put anything in that area yet. So I just got all these points because I barely placed any tiles in there. But because I couldn't place this one other tile, game was over and I scored a ton of points. So you can sort of play it that way as well. It's super, super simple to teach. I taught my cousin yesterday and another friend of mine who I've just met that barely plays games. And they both picked it up super quick. We played 2 rounds in half an hour, you know, and had a blast. So they just wanted to keep playing over and over again because, once again, it's so quick. It looks really satisfying. You're trying to work on 4 different puzzles at once and try to, you know, figure out if this is going to fit there. And you're working in such a tight space with all these randomly shaped things. It was phenomenal. It was a really good game. That was Junk Draw. It was really, really fun. I believe there's a bunch of places that might have it for pre-order at the moment. I've just pre-ordered myself a copy. But I recommend everyone definitely try to get themselves a go on this game, Junk Draw. It's really, really fun.
So you can effectively rush the end if you think you're in a position of winning. Is that like, is that a
it's hard to,
in your few plays of playing, a viable strategy?
I don't think so, because you don't know what piece is going to come out. So you can't necessarily plan. Like, there's a button, which is one square big, you know? There's all these different shapes. No. You might be able to if you purposely put big chunky pieces in one of the other areas, but that way of playing probably won't work well for you because that's got its own set of rules. And if you try to do that, you might just score nothing for that area and a lot of points for that one other area. It's about balancing it out and trying to get as many points as you can throughout the whole thing. So I don't think you could do that as a viable strategy, but you could certainly try. Yeah, but that was Junk Draw. It was a really, really fun game.
Sounds good.
Thanks for the game chat, guys. That was awesome. We're going to move over to some other areas, but we've got a couple quick announcements to throw at you guys. The Board Game Barbecue is coming to South by Southwest and PAX coming up in the near future. If you're not aware, South by Southwest is a huge festival that's normally, I think, in Texas and America, and it's finally coming to Australia. That's going to be in October. From the 18th and the 22nd in Sydney, and a bunch of us Board Game Barbecue crew are going to be up there running some events and playing some games with people. They're going to be selling wristbands for gamers. So if you look at the tickets, they are very expensive tickets to go to the whole event. But if you're focused on one area of the event, like gaming, they are going to be selling wristbands that you can get just to attend the gaming area. On the 18th, we will be at Fortress Tavern playing games in the afternoon, and we'll be running a board game barbecue trivia night in the evening there. They also have a tabletop festival on the 21st and the 22nd, which are full days of board gaming, hanging out and having fun with the crew. So if you're in Sydney or want to come up to Sydney for a bit of a visit, the South by Southwest event will be absolutely awesome. And we look forward to seeing you folks there. If you are coming, make sure you jump onto our socials and let us know so we know to look out for you there. And Condog, what's happening for PAX?
For PAX, we will be at PAX again. So we will be there from the 6th, 7th, and 8th in Melbourne. We will not be running our tabletop space again, but instead we'll be there interviewing people, hanging out, still playing games, and hoping to see a few of you there. So if you joined us last year at PAX, we had an absolute blast. It was 3 days of just top shelf fun, looking forward to going back there this year, and we'll be looking to make some more content while we're there as well. That's the 6th, 7th, and 8th in Melbourne. And just another quick note, the Sydney game day is the 23rd of the 23rd, it says on their run sheet, the 23rd of September. Grab your tickets now. That's at the Castle Hill RSL. So another great day coming up in the late September for all the Sydney board gamers.
That's awesome, Colin. Thanks. And from that, we'll go into the question of the pod.
If you're looking for a new board game, you need to check out adventgames.com.au. They have a great range of games, including pre-orders and hot new games. Anything you could be looking for will be there at Advent. Dean provides excellent customer service that is second to none, and he's always keen to support the Australian board game community through events, game days, and even through sponsoring a podcast. So head over to adventgames.com.au today. That's adventgames.com.au.
Last Let's week's question of the pod was, what is the best two-player only game you have ever played? Matt, do you want to lead us up for this, mate? What's some of your favorite two-player games?
Yeah, I do play a lot. That is the primary way I play was with my wife, basically. So just two-player games. I think it'd be hard not to say something like Lost Cities, I have to admit, in terms of like, if we're talking about two-player only games, I think, yeah, it's just, I mean, we still play it now, like, what, 10 years after we've been playing, you know, there's not many games you could say that you pull out and just, you always want to play again after you play one game and just the kind of the elegance in that. I will say a shout out. I don't think it gets talked about very much anymore, but like the Agricola two-player game is very, very good in my opinion, and is a really great kind of like if you want like a kind of crunchy Euro experience, but within, you know, like 30, 35 minutes, and has a lot of its own little twists on the Agricola formula, which make a lot of sense in two players. Like it's a really, really smart design and also has some really fun expansions. So if you like the kind of like engine building kind of variability thing, you know, in the base game you have these four special buildings that you're able to build, but then you have expansions which you can add in more special buildings. They start like breaking the rules in interesting ways, and I'd probably put those two as the first on my list. But what about you folks?
I'm glad you said that though. I've had Lost Cities. I've been obsessed with. I only found out about it recently and obsessed. That is such a genius game. But Agricola, the two-player game, I bought ages ago. It's been on the shelf for shame, and you've just encouraged me to want to crack that out soon and give it a go. Connor, what have some of the socials been saying about the best two-player in the game? Or do you have one to throw in there first before we continue?
Actually, one of my options is is what someone on the socials have said. So I'll run through Facey first. So Dana has said Taji or Targi. I always get pulled up on the pronunciation of that. Simple and clean with an interesting tussle for two. My other one would be Hana Mikoji, another favorite I play with an old friend that always gave our brains a workout for just a small card game. Chris Ingold said the official answer is Star Wars Rebellion, right? Which is damn good, but I might go for Codenames Duet. Shane has said beer and bread for a quick game, however, Star Wars Rebellion for the long haul. Gene said the one and only Netrunner. So that's pretty good as well. And Paul Harold said, Onitama, such a simple design, but it works so well. Then from Discord, Jay Benedictson said, shout out to a two-player only game. I haven't actually played with another human, but was obsessed with for a while when I got the app, so two-player of me versus the bot, and that's Nurashima Hex. It's such a cool mix of abstract strategy and tactical skirmish. Stuz has said, I've had a good time with Claustrophobia several times. It does get to the table often, but when it does, fun when it does. Ben has said, for a quick game of both Hive and Patchwork, the games to go, I've really enjoyed playing Motion Pictures for a two-player cooperative experience. And if you want a proper challenge, I highly recommend... That's gone. It's not there anymore. So yeah, recommend something, but I don't know what it was. So let us know. And the one that I was going to mention was Caesar. So Caesar, which I learned last year at PAX, in terms of a area control game and how easy it is to play, I can't find one that's better. So so Caesar, it's got a little subtitle, but I can't remember. Everyone knows it's Caesar. It's the younger sibling of Blitzkrieg. So yeah, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Caesar, the something or other.
Yeah, of Rome.
<That one. laughs> I've got heaps of two-player games I love, and you know, I struggle to think of them when it comes to me. But Lost Cities is definitely up there for me. Patchwork, I absolutely love. I love Unmatched as a two-player game. I feel that's more of a two-player game, definitely. And the other one I was going to mention was Hero Realms. I absolutely love a two-player. Let's attack each other. Hero Realms is amazing.
I got one more. Undaunted. Undaunted. so good. Such a great card battler. You know, thematic war game without it being an actual, you know, punch token war game. Just fantastic. But yeah.
So having a chat with Matt and Connor, we've decided the new question of the pod to ask the community is, what game do you think needs a new expansion? What game do we want to see more content for? We love how Postmark have used the community to bring out new content, their DLCs, have, if you will, for their games like Voyages. So what games do you think are crying out for some new expansion content? Make sure you jump onto our socials like Discord, Facebook, even Twitter and Instagram these days, and let us know what game you think needs a new expansion.
X, not Twitter. X.
X, X. As soon as you think of exhibit, X gonna give it to you.
Yeah. So a game I would like to see an expansion for is I would love to see Imperial Assault, so the Star Wars game for Imperial Assault, but I want them to delve back. I want them to use the Star Wars novels as characters. So the Star Wars novels, they're not part of canon anymore. I'm a big Star Wars nuffy when it comes to this stuff, and some of my favorite characters are from the expanded universe. So I've talked about how I want like a Star Wars LCG campaign game. Imperial Assault, I don't think it's happening anymore. They've got too many, you know, too many tongs in the fire when it comes to Star Wars. But I would love to see some more story content where they sort of divert. It's almost like a parallel universe. So it's like a parallel universe of characters that they use. What about you, Matt? What DLC, as you said, would you like to see for games?
Well, it's not really fair because it's a game that's already had plenty of expansions, but I just want another Race for the Galaxy expansion.
Another one.
Not enough.
Well, it's just like I love what Tom Lehman's able to do with, like, he has like different arcs of expansions that kind of introduces new things, and they've just all been great in kind of different ways, and I would just love I just want another expansion. I can't get enough of the game. So it's not a very fair answer. Well, I think the interesting thing is that his approach also was that he never thought that all the expansions should be played together. It was very much about like if you would just use one or two at a time and they'd curate a different experience. I think it's a really interesting way to approach it and to kind of, he was really cognizant of the fact that once you start adding cards, that changes the probability of drawing certain things or certain combinations being available to players. So he never wanted things to get too big, too out of hand, too random. And so I just love to see the next, you know, that next kind of like little snapshot of the game with one new expansion. It doesn't, you know, it's not about making the game big. It's just a different iteration of it almost.
I think for me, mine, I know it's going to come. I don't know what it is, but I've been hanging out for it. I've just sold my OG Clank with all the expansions because I love Clank Catacombs so much. I really love Clank Catacombs. And come on, guys, give me my new expansions. I want new cool things to happen in there. I think there's a lot of room for some new interesting mechanics in that game as well. And the game is already my absolute favorite Clank game that's come out. But I'm just hanging. I'm hanging for some more Clank goodness in Catacombs. So,
you know, there's a second Acquisitions Incorporated coming out, yeah? There's a second Clank Legacy.
It's really backed. Around. That's happening. I would have
expected nothing less from you.
No, my game group, we've that sort of kicked off me having a separate little legacy game group now that we meet up weekly and play legacy games. So as soon as that was announced, which was literally weeks after finishing our OG Clank Legacy run, we said, we're back in that. Yeah, like, yeah, done. We'll put in for it. And we backed it straight away. I would back two copies of that to play it twice. That's such a fun experience.
All right, just before we move on to our final little bit, I just want to give a shout out to some of our patrons. So Pav, Rainier, Ryan, and Samuel Mason. So thank you, you guys. You all know who you are, and we could not run this show without you. And we're so pleased to have you on there. I attended last night a Jackbox Party Pack get together. So that's something that you get access to if you wish to be a patron, amongst other things, which you can sign up to at patreon.com/boardgamebarbecue. That will let you get exclusive podcast episodes and other content as well, including get-togethers for different parts of our game days. But remember, if you do not feel like donating, there are plenty of ways to support that us without donating. You can go to Apple Podcasts and leave a star rating. Dan, last time I was on, got an absolute cracker one from my friend Sub-Zero Joe. That was so good about Arkham Horror. You can use Spotify's new star rating system. It only takes a few seconds of your time, but it means the world to us. You can get involved in the Board Game Barbecue community by joining Facebook, following us on X, Instagram, and YouTube. And of course, there's our amazing Discord community. So many conversations about games and random stuff going on there. At the moment, Baldur's Gate 3 is like the big topic of conversation in the video game section. Everyone's playing that, making me feel super envious and jealous because I can't get it until the end of this week. So yeah, there's all stuff going on. There's a food channel, there's movies, there's TV, and then there's board games and great times to get involved in. So all the links are in the show notes below. But with that, sorry to steal thunder, Mike, we're on to swearing and oath.
Boom, swearing and oath. Now, this is exciting. It's not often that we have a guest on that we can ask if they kept their oath. I think, should we save it till last, Connor?
Let's save it till last.
We're going to save it. Do you remember what your oath was?
No.
Oh, I was going to let that sizzle there. I was going to let it sizzle.
It's going to simmer. This is slow cooked oath.
I will kick us off. I'll kick us off.
Watch what you call me.
I failed my last oath of playing the others, I believe it was. And so I added onto that oath to play the others and to play Zombicide with the boys' characters. And I would like to say that I successfully did both. The others have been sitting on my shelf of shame for like 3 years. And I don't know why it intimidated me to get off the shelf. And that's why I swore an oath to play it. It's not that hard. And I think I was worried someone talked it up for me. And I think I was worried about that disappointment. You know, when someone tells you a good TV show and you want to like it and you're worried you're not going to like it, I think I had that vibe going on. But I played the others. It's made by CMON. It's got similar-ish vibes to Zombicide, but it's a 1v-all game where one person is playing one of the seven deadly sins versus a bunch of people trying to take him down. And man, it's amazing. I really, really like it. I've played it twice now, and both times were an absolute blast. It's really hard trying to balance playing the sin character. It's really hard trying to take everyone down. And I had one success, one failure so far. I'm liking it that much. It might be a future sizzle, I think. So I'm not going to talk too much about it right now. The boys' character packs for Zombicide, oh my God. We played yesterday and we had an absolute blast. All I'll say is that the theme of the boys gets mixed in really, really well. When you play if anyone hasn't seen the boys TV show, it is pretty crazy. It might not be for everyone, but you're playing with like superheroes. And the superheroes in the game have a special superpower at the start of the game straight away. So because it makes the game easier, you have to add a bunch more zombies into the game. So we were getting swarmed and taking out big wads of zombies all at once. And it was an amazing big blast. Highly recommend if you're a fan of that show. It gets you right into that theme. I actually used it to introduce a new friend to Zombicide yesterday who is a big fan of the boys. And he found it really thematic and really enjoyed it. And oh, so cool. It was awesome. But I have successfully done those oaths. My next oath is to play a new game that just came in that I'm very excited for. It's The Witcher Old World.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of the TV series. I'm a fan of deck builders. The game looks amazing, and I recently got a copy of it. So I'm really excited to try it. But I've actually decided to add an extra oath on, even though I don't have to. I'm feeling guilty that I'm sitting here with Matt today, and I'm one of the backers of Voyages. I backed it, and I was so excited to get a Kickstarter straight away, and I printed it, and I laminated it, and I went on the shelf, and I never got it off. And once again, I think it's that hard thing that there's no box to sort of remind me. It's a couple pieces of paper on the side of my thing, and I even bought like new dice just to have spare to play these sort of print and plays to encourage them enough to dig through other boxes to get dice. And I'm feeling guilty here. I'm feeling guilty.
I have a hint. Get into Warhammer. You'll always have dice.
Or D&D. Or D&D. Yeah. I am tacking on for you, Matt, today. I'm going to tack on that I will also play Voyages by the time I'm next on the podcast.
Thank you.
Condog.
Well, I'm going to follow up your super successful oath with a not so successful oath. So mine was to start the Scarlet Keys campaign for the Arkham Horror Living Card Game. And even with Sub-Zero Joe's like incredible oath that he made Dan make by making read a review, I haven't done it yet. For me, it's something that I need to do over a long weekend because I've got to build my decks, I've got to choose my characters, all that type of stuff, set it up. So I will do it. I kind of – maybe I can take a sick day from work and take the Friday off and do that. You know, maybe be, you know, sick by some Eldritch illness. But we don't rest on our laurels here. I'm going to add two, but one's going to have a proviso. So if it arrives before I'm on the show next, I will play and begin a campaign of Oathsworn. So that's supposedly coming soon. I haven't got a notification from any deliverers to say it's coming. It's because I don't know if it's through Aetherworks or whatever, but I'm hoping it'll be here soon. I'm on the show again in like two or three more weeks, so it may or may not happen. But if it doesn't arrive by then, I will also play a solo game called Reckland's Run that I got before I went on my trip to Europe. So I kind of divine swear the next time on the show, I will have either played Reckland's Run or, hopefully even better, Oathsworn, something of the Deepwood.
Awesome. Looking forward to hearing about it. Yeah. And Matt, your suspense is over. Your oath was to finish your food-based game. I believe it was something about flavors. They had a food-based game. It's not released yet, I don't believe, but has it been created?
No, I haven't finished it, sadly. It is still on the in my defense, I have moved countries in that interim time. So I think I should
we've had, that's the most valid, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think yes. I can give you a freebie.
So I could renew that oath that I will endeavor by the next time I'm on the podcast in another 2 years' time.
You'll make two food-based games.
Well, let's just get one. I mean, let's, one really good one. You know, that's good enough.
I like it. Look, Matt, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And before we let you go, are there any other announcements or anything you want to plug on the podcast tonight before I let you go?
No, nothing in particular, except just to say, if you want to see the Postmark Games, you go to our website, postmarkgames.com, all one word. You can tell I'm not much of a marketer and I've only just remembered. But I have remembered, so that's I'm better than most. But yeah, and I'll also be at PAX as well. It'll be my very first PAX. So if you do see me, do feel free to come and say hello. I'm always happy to chat about games or play something. So yeah, I'll be around. And showing off... a new game, actually, which I will be announced soon. But yeah, a new narrative game with Dave Neal, who was my co-designer on Echoes. So yeah, something to look forward to.
Awesome.
Fantastic. The barbecue will definitely catch up with you at PAX to have more of a chat about that, man. I'm looking forward to it.
Definitely.
Fantastic. Yeah. On that note, thank you again, Matt. And thank you, Connor, for joining us tonight.
Pleasure as always. It was fantastic, Matt. Thanks for the chat.
Thank you. Awesome.
That was awesome learning a bit more about the games that we already enjoy. So that was a bit of a treat. So I really enjoyed that. So thank you everyone for listening. Go and play some games. Yeah.